So on today's podcast episode, we're going to spend about an hour talking about something that never happened. And that's the Fourth Reich, a Nazi resurgence, the creation of a successor state to Hitler's Germany. But I think you're going to see in the context of this conversation why that's so important. In this discussion with Gav Rosenfeld, we're going to be talking about, first of all, how there were actually very real attempts to birth a new Nazi state, a successor to the Third Reich, but also how this term, the Fourth Reich, changed in meaning, was reflected in popular culture, and is even part of our language for understanding politics today. So let's jump right in. I think you're going to find this to be a really, really interesting episode with lots of different directions that we can go. One of which is, how and why do we write a history of something that never happened? So I hope you'll really enjoy this episode. I know I enjoyed recording it. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Holocaust History Podcast. I'm your host, Waitman Bourne. And today we have a really interesting guest, Gav Rosenfeld, who has written about the Fourth Reich and this fictional feared resurgence of the Nazis. But I think you might think you know what that is. But I suspect that by the time we get done with this conversation, you'll have a completely different appreciation. So, Gav, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Waitman.
Yeah, tell us a little about yourself, first of all. What do you do? Where are you from? What are you working on?
Sure. Well, I'm sitting in New York City right now at the Center for Jewish History, where I'm the president as of last September 2022. I'm currently on leave from my main position as a professor of history at Fairfield University up in Connecticut. I'll be here at the Center for Jewish History at least until the end of 2025. We are the largest archive of Jewish sources in the world, certainly outside of the State of Israel, which has the National Library of Israel, which is a larger library but smaller archive. And I could get into a lot more detail on all the amazing sources that we have dating back to the Middle Ages. But there's basically 6 linear miles worth of documents here in Midtown Manhattan, right off of Union Square. I'm doing a bunch of different things with regard to fellowship program development, fundraising, programming, and it's basically public history at its best. So I'm at your disposal to talk about the Nazis from a public history perspective and a podcasting perspective.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is a thing that, as you write in the book, it doesn't really go away. How did you get into it? Because I don't want to spoil, but got a little bit of feedback there. How did you come to write a book about something that never happened?
Right. So obviously, as a historian of Nazi Germany, I, like yourself, have always been talking about and been interested in the Third Reich. But it's impossible in researching this Reich not to be aware of the previous two Reichs that preceded Nazi Germany, the First and Second Reichs, which we don't have to get into the details of. But at the same time, since I've done a lot of research about the memory of Nazism in the sphere of popular culture, I came across a bunch of pulpy works of fiction and schlocky films that thematized the Fourth Reich. And I'd always sort of just viewed that as a signifier of the fear of a Nazi resurgence at some point in the distant future. And that wasn't really a thing I thought of with great urgency. But really over the last 10, 15 years, I started to notice in the mass media and online spaces how the term Fourth Reich was being weaponized and politicized by various people to attack their opponents. So whether it was, for example, after the 2008 financial crisis, activists in Greece who were protesting Angela Merkel's austerity policies in the EU and were attacking Germany as a Fourth Reich, or whether it was activists after the on the political left after President Trump was elected in 2016, who feared that his administration would inaugurate a Fourth Reich in America, or Vladimir Putin attacking Ukraine as a place that's fostering a Fourth Reich. It seemed that the history of the term itself maybe needed a little bit more analysis. And so a combination of just interest in the possible resurgence of any Nazi movement and this moniker, the slogan that you see bandied about in so many different ways, inspired me to just try and historicize it by tracing its roots back to the early 20th century. And as we'll probably make clear in our conversation, it has a very unusual and interesting history. So this book, The Fourth Reich, basically traces its evolution over time from the 20s and 30s up to the present.
Yeah, and before we even get to that, can we go back a little even further than that? Because you bring up some things, you know, that certainly I wasn't aware of in terms of sort of the Christian origins of the third kingdom, I suppose, right? Where does this come from, and then how does it play into German history, bringing us up to sort of the Third Reich or the actual Third Reich?
So there's a lot of detail that the first chapter of the book gets into. I'll try and just gloss the larger points. But the question of any Reich, which of course literally means empire or realm, does have Christian origins in the Middle Ages. And this idea of a first Reich, a second Reich, and a third Reich, even before we get into the questions of the German polity dating back to the Holy Roman Empire, it has a lot to do with the Christian idea of the Trinity, you know, the Father, Son, and the Spirit. And there was an Italian, I don't remember if he was a Franciscan or Benedictine monk in the Middle Ages, who sort of came up with this tripartite definition of earthly and spiritual empires that had numbers associated with them. And that later became interspersed with conversations about in the Hebrew Bible, the four earthly kingdoms of the Assyrians and Babylonians and Romans and so forth. And while, you know, it would probably take a much longer conversation to tease out how they evolved over time, suffice it to say that during the Nazi years in the 1920s, when the Third Reich was first conceived, not by the Nazis themselves, or I should say the 1920s when the Nazis were getting off the ground as a party, there were already people like Arthur Müller Vandenbroek who were conceiving of some utopian German future where the shortcomings of the second Kaiserreich, the Wilhelmine Empire, would be overcome and a great new sort of synthesis of German political, social, and economic harmony would ensue. That became one of the things that Hitler and the Nazis took on after 1930, as they were becoming an increasingly viable political party. They used it as a slogan to try and inspire some of their voting base to see the Nazi Party as not just representing, you know, or offering a solution to the bread and butter concerns of Germans in the Great Depression, but something more meta-historical and salvific, if you will, millenarian even. And so it became something that galvanized a lot of people at the time. Had that set of origins, but I don't know if you want to get yet into how the Fourth Reich emerged from a very different political wing of the spectrum around the same time.
Yeah, I think this is a transition to that, right? Because one of the things, and I mentioned this on Twitter, that I, you know, one of the great things about doing this podcast is that I learn stuff, right? Because certainly none of us know everything. But I didn't know that Hitler had actually sort of outlawed the use of the phrase the Third Reich because of the Fourth Reich being used essentially initially as a criticism in some way. I mean, maybe that's the transition, right? Of where does that the Fourth Reich actually in some ways originates as a positive thing.
Exactly. So today, the people who would use the term Fourth Reich are either neo-Nazis who use it as a term of aspiration, or it's anti-fascist types, anti-Nazis, who want to at least claim that the people who they're advocating on behalf of are advocating on behalf of, you know, progressive liberal democratic values, and they're opposed to any wannabe fascists who they would say are, you know, promoting a right-wing agenda that would potentially culminate in a Fourth Reich. So today, the Fourth Reich is very much associated with the far right, but in the 1930s, it goes without saying that when Hitler finally established his Third Reich, a lot of the anti-Nazi opponents of Hitler, whether they were members of the Social Democratic Party who went into exile, or whether they were German Jewish refugees who fled to the Upper West Side of Manhattan, Morningside Heights, they came up with the idea that once the Third Reich could be toppled, or at least be gotten rid of one way or the other, that Germany could recover its liberal democratic heritage and become a Fourth Reich. In other words, the Fourth Reich had a progressive set of associations surrounding it. And there were plenty of people, even Thomas and Heinrich Mann, who were sort of loosely referred to in their American exile as the sort of presidents in exile of the Fourth Reich. And from the Nazi perspective, I mean, I have plenty of quotations from leading Nazi Gauleiters and so forth, who made it clear that the Fourth Reich was a treasonous phrase, and they used all their efforts to try and stamp it out. And in the late 1930s, if I'm not mistaken, after the Anschluss of Austria and then after the Sudeten crisis, Hitler takes the phrase Third Reich, as you correctly pointed out of circulation. And it's not exactly clear why, but some argue that at this point in time, as he's gearing up for war, and as he wants the German people to understand that the future for them is going to be about military conquest and securing of a larger empire, he really preferred the phrase the Grosse Germanisches Reich, the Greater German Empire, as something, as an alternative to the Third Reich, because the Third Reich really was already established in 1933. And really, from Hitler's perspective, that phrase had done its job. And what have you done for me lately? It's not really going to galvanize people to move forward into a new phase of conquest. So he basically sent the phrase packing. And you see it disappear from that point on.
Yeah, I mean, that to me already was really interesting, but also is a nice transition into this discussion of what happens after. But maybe, you know, before we get into sort of attempts to recreate the Third Reich, you know, this seems to be something that at least some Nazis were already interested in when they saw the writing on the wall, or at least towards the end of the actual Third Reich. Right. So how do we transition from sort of, you know, the Fourth Reich as aspirational sort of liberal improvement, or, you know, better improvement over the Nazis, to we're losing the Third Reich and now let's plan for, you know, actually, because one of the tensions that goes through your discussion is this one of, you know, how much of the Fourth Reich, the idea of a Fourth Reich, is a rhetorical flourish, and how much of it is an actual plan, you know, of political essentially reconquest or something like this.
Right. So you put your finger on it. I mean, so part of the book deals with what I would just call discourse history and tracing the origins of a concept and the changing uses of a concept. But there's also a there. I do insist throughout the book that it's also an effort to analyze the fantasies and plots and potentially even coup attempts of who I would call unrepentant Nazis. You know, today we're always on the prowl trying to find out where the neo-Nazis are. And it's perhaps an open question when we make that transition after 1945 in history from the ex-Nazis and the unrepentant Nazis to the neo-Nazis, because, you know, there's a generational shift that probably requires one to go through before you're a neo-anything. But suffice it to say that, you know, after 1945, when Germany was devastated and under Allied occupation for 4 years, it's not the case that everyone just sort of knuckled under and accepted Allied rule. There were people who wanted to engage in, you know, what the Iraqi resistance did after the 2003 invasion of Iraq. They wanted to engage in an insurgency. They wanted to engage in sniper attacks, IED actions and whatnot. And I do talk about in the early chapters how there were a bunch of different movements and conspiracies by unrepentant Nazis to return to power. And some of those actors were, in fact, inspired by the idea of creating a Fourth Reich. And by the same token, a lot of the military government officials in Britain and the United States and countless journalists in the Anglo-American media were frequently using the term Fourth Reich to warn their audiences that there were still Nazis on the scene and they had to be dealt with severely if the project of rebuilding Germany into a succeed.
Yeah, I'm just gonna pause. I think there's some kind of like feedback from the mic. It sounds like that. I don't know if you're clicking on something or.
Oh, I was clicking on something.
Okay, it's okay. It's just like
it was tense. Yeah. I'll stop that.
And then as time goes on, then it becomes sort of this the more sleeper agent-y kind of approach to it.
Yeah. In the last months of World War II, in the late winter, early, there was a whole effort by the SS to create a domestic insurgency led by teenagers, essentially, people in the Hitler Youth, some SS members, some representatives of the Wehrmacht, to just engage in partisan attacks against Allied forces as a way to do what irregular German troops did during the Napoleonic invasions in the early 1800s and so forth during the 30 Years' War as well. So they hearkened back to earlier precedents in German history. But the thought was we need to make life, hell for Allied soldiers once German territory is actually seized. And the hope was, of course, that the Allied forces would eventually tire of all the sniper attacks and acts of sabotage and they would just leave. This was taken so seriously by people like Dwight Eisenhower that the whole myth of the Alpine Redoubt, in southern Bavaria, in the Alpine region, there were fears that there would have been hundreds of thousands of soldiers in, salt mines and all kinds of other fortresses. And if I understand it correctly, in the march towards Berlin, some American troops peeled off to make sure that that part of Bavaria was secured. And the werewolf myth kind of hovered over all of this. It's not the case that there weren't any werewolf forces or attacks. In fact, there were, but they mostly claimed German victims. So that, for example, in the last weeks of the war, when Hitler in March of 45 issued his Nero order to just basically lay waste to all Germany's infrastructure, a lot of anti-Nazi villagers and townspeople decided to countermand those orders and resist them. And some Nazi officials throughout the country ended up using werewolf forces to quell that quote-unquote defeatism. And there are some notorious massacres that take place in the last phase of the war where werewolf soldiers are implicated. And then after the war, there certainly were scattered acts of sabotage. But in the Western media, you see that this prospect of German resistance was very, very hyped, at least for the first couple months after the conflict ended. And then the fears of the Western allies shift over to other resistance elements and potential coup attempts, which I also talk about in other parts of the book.
Yeah, and I want to talk about those because I mean, certainly one of the things, I didn't realize even, I always sort of had bought into that same sort of myth. And you talk about, how even historians have kind of contributed to this by suggesting, essentially with the benefit of hindsight, saying, look, none of these things had any chance of success. You know, but actually, you know, there are some very real attempts at doing this. But before I get to that, I want to ask you to highlight something that I thought was really insightful about this idea, which is the effect that having a divided Germany had on the motivations for this kind of insurgent resistance. Because you make a really interesting point about what might have happened had the Soviet Union occupied all of Germany, or vice versa, had the Allies Western Allies occupied all of Germany, and how, had either of those things happened, we might actually have had a much more dangerous and widespread insurgency. Yeah.
No, it's an interesting silver lining in terms of from the Cold War, I guess you'd say. So the argument I made is that having read a lot of really interesting research, by Perry Bittescom and others, Volker Koppe, about the actual werewolf phenomenon, it became pretty clear to me as they documented that the most severe and radical violence perpetrated by werewolf forces were in the East, was in the East. And that makes sense because there's a lot of ethnic cleansing of German populations at the end of the war. There was much more violence by Red Army forces against the German civilian population. And, you know, in response, the reprisals of werewolf forces and German troops more broadly in that area were much more severe. I argued that if the Soviet Union had occupied all of Germany, you would have probably had the same kind of werewolf violence because Soviet retribution would have been much more egregious. We're all familiar, of course, with the mass rapes and the looting and massacres and so forth. Ironically, though, what I argue is that because the entire western part of Germany was occupied by the correspondingly milder forces of the British, French, and the U.S., that most werewolf forces who would have been tempted to rebel actually realized they had it pretty easy because, comparatively speaking, you would have much rather, as a German, as an ex-Wehrmacht soldier or an SS man, you'd much prefer living under Western Allied rule than under Soviet rule. And in fact, it's well known that many German soldiers fled from the East to the West for the comparative safety of the Western occupation zones. So in a way, it's sort of the famous good cop, bad cop analogy. The very brutal treatment of Germans in the Eastern zone led, I think, any potential insurgents in the West to sort of figure to themselves, what's the point? We're much better off here. And so the actual violence that ended up appearing in the West was correspondingly mild. And by the same token, if the United States and Western Allies had occupied all of Germany, all the way to, you know, the Oder River, probably you would have seen the same thing, because then potential rebels wouldn't have known how much worse it could have been under Soviet rule, and they might have just rebelled against Allied rule. So it's, in a way, it was the split between the punitive Soviets and the comparatively mild Western Allies that may have nipped some of this in the bud.
Yeah, so what are the... Can you tell us just some of these plots, right? Because I thought they're really interesting, you know, of people actually, this wasn't rhetorical. These were ex-Nazis, you know, one of the streams that runs through the book, but also this idea in general that I think is worth considering. And one that I found really interesting, of course, is just how many Nazis, many of whom were quite high level, were able to just kind of re-enter society, you know, in variety of ways. And in fact, one of the things that was a bit surprising to me, you know, was the very early allowance of far-right parties, political parties, even in a West Germany that was clearly cognizant of these things, mm-hmm. and was not sort of supportive of them. But, you know, we often look at, you know, Holocaust denial in Germany, right, which is illegal, right, and sometimes people say, well, you know, that's kind of heavy handed, but yet even early on, they're allowing these far right parties to at least exist. I mean, they're not being, as you point out, they're not being incredibly successful electorally, but they're also not being outright outlawed either.
Yeah, no, I think it's an excellent point. I mean, one of the larger arguments of the book is that because post-war Germany ended up being a success story, it's tempting for historians to basically say there were never any bumps in the road, and the, you know, Erfolgsgeschichte, the success story of post-war Germany in terms of political stability and economic prosperity, was all sort of baked in from the beginning, and there were no moments when things could have gone otherwise. I, in fact, say it's the exact opposite. There were plenty of moments, especially in the very, very vulnerable years of 1945 to, I would say, really 57, certainly to 53, where there were possibilities for Germany's experiment democracy to go off the rails. You know, keep in mind that while today the German Supreme Court can ban political parties, that wasn't actually done until, for the first time, 1952, when the Socialist Reich Party was banned, and then in 56 when the KPD. And the reason why that wasn't done until the early 50s is that the Supreme Court hadn't actually been empowered to do that until late in the game. Just by the same token, you know, we can't, Germans can't say things in public or show certain Nazi symbols in public because it would be seen as Volksverhetzung and, you know, hate speech. That law only came into being in the, I think, in 1960 after the infamous swastika wave of 1959, 1960. So a lot of what we today credit as Germany's militant democracy took place against the backdrop of ongoing fears of a Nazi resurgence. So that's certainly worth keeping in mind. But it also led me to basically make sense of a lot of stuff I was seeing in the primary source press coverage of events that I'd never, ever heard of before. So when I think of two famous coup attempts from between 1945 and 1947, really, that were crushed by Allied forces. One was known as Operation Nursery, which crushed a coup attempt by the Hitler Youth veterans led by Arthur Oxmann, who was Baldur von Schirach's successor, who took charge of the Hitler Youth, I think, in 1940, and who was actually in the bunker with Hitler and Bormann till the bitter end. He slunk off to southern Germany after 1945, but was merely biding his time, waiting to become the next Führer, hoping to infiltrate Allied military government agencies by bringing his Hitler Youth officers, getting them involved in infiltration activities so that they could sort of rig the system, if you will, of Allied rule until they would take off, and then they would have positions of power and influence. Fortunately, a lot of the military government agencies where these Hitler Youth types had made their presence in were also filled with spies. So they got basically exposed to British military government officials and some American military government officials. And in early 1946, there was a huge arrest wave where over 1,000 people were arrested with some shots fired between Allied and German forces. And then for several weeks, there were just blazing headlines in the American and British press, you know, Nazi coup attempt squelched. And I thought to myself, well, I've never heard of Operation Nursery. I've never heard of Arthur Oxmann. I never heard that there was a plot to create a Fourth Reich, as a recent author wrote in chronicling the Oxmann effort. But that wasn't even the only one. Operation Selection Board, about a year later, also crushed a coup attempt of former SS officers, Wehrmacht forces, and some other Nazi Gauleiters to infiltrate also Allied forces and to try and convince them to consider rearming Germany as a neutral power at a time when the Cold War hadn't yet brought Germany into the Western Alliance. That had to be suppressed as well. And so what you really see, and I sort of zoom out in the section of the book where I talk about these, to point out that in the very vulnerable years, 45, 46, 47, the German people were in such desperate circumstances that they were a ready audience for extremism. Remember that the average calorie intake of Germans was under 1,000 calories a day. Allied military government policy hadn't yet switched over to a Reconstructionist approach. It was still very punitive. There was tremendous resentment about denazification. And all of that was leading some Germans, desperate as they were, to contemplate alternatives to liberal democracy. And yeah, you do see support for right-wing parties, which, yes, in fact, are legal at this point in time. Fortunately, for at least a good four-year period, Allied military officials were the backstop that were able to make sure that German democracy didn't get sabotaged from within.
And one of the things that I think is so important, and this is one of those, you know, historians at home, you know, young historian students at home, you know, the role and the importance that you give to counterfactuals, I think is really just an interesting aside as well that goes into this, right? Which mm-hmm. is, you know, that it's important to recognize, you know, people at the time didn't know that there wouldn't be a mass, that Nazis weren't behind every door trying to, you know, reconstitute the Third Reich or hadn't infiltrated everything. And you can imagine, you know, it seems obvious, but, you know, it took, you know, you to write it where, you know, yeah, if you were in Nazi Germany, if you were in Germany post-war in 46, 47, and you uncover a plot by a bunch of former Nazis to literally take over Germany, of course you're going to be writing headlines and stories about, you know, how, you know, frightening this is, because, you know, here we are, you know, essentially at that point, right, the third time in a century worrying about a sort of aggressive resurgent Germany. So these, you know, it makes sense that these plots would be taken seriously, more than it makes sense now looking back that they're being poo-pooed by, you know, by scholars today, right?
That's the retroactive justification phenomenon that we see so often, or what we call hindsight bias. Just because nothing was ever decisively torpedoed in Germany's post-war democratization doesn't mean that there weren't serious attempts to do that. And so I always like to quote Hugh Trevor Roper's comment that history is not what happened, it's what happened in the context of what might have happened. And so to be able to always juxtapose the outcome of history with other possible forking paths of development that history could have followed had only one or two variables been different, I think that's always a useful thing to keep in mind. And honestly, the whole history of Western historiography is full of people mulling over the what-ifs of everything from the Peloponnesian War to the Persian Wars. And I'm writing a big book right now kind of actually documenting the history of what-if thinking among historians since Herodotus and Thucydides all the way up to the present, which, you know, is a kind of a tall order, but there's plenty of what-ifs to be charted and identified in the documentary record. But I try to apply it in this book to, you know, make sense of the fears of people at the time, because any history of the Fourth Reich is the history of fears. And we know in our present day political climate of, you know, since 2015 and the rise of Trump and MAGAism, that sometimes fears are hyperbolic and sometimes fears are justified. And, you know, there is this famous idea called the overreaction paradox, where if, you know, you look back on history and you see how everybody, you know, cried wolf and lost their minds, and we say that because nothing ever happened. Well, we don't know if nothing ever happened because we did lose our minds and overreacted, because, you know, what's, you know, better safe than sorry is usually the motto.
Well, to take it in a completely different direction, but just for, you know, this is also the prevention of genocide problem, you know, which is how do we, you know, because often in order to prevent genocide, you have to intervene in somebody else's internal, you know, political affairs. And so how do you prove after the fact that that was justified mm-hmm. if in fact genocide hasn't occurred because you prevented it in the first place, right? But I mean, with the
Absolutely. With
the Trump thing, I think is really interesting because we're in this moment, and we'll get back to the history in a minute, but, you know, we're in this moment where a lot of people and a lot of smart people and a lot of smart, serious people are sort of saying, look, we are in a danger zone, at least in the United States, when it comes to sort of democracy and fascism and extremism and a rise in the popularity of those latter two ideas. You know, to the extent that some people are saying, you know, they're literally asking the question, was this what it was like to be living in like 1920s or late 20s, early 30s Germany? You know, like, are we, yeah. are we the toad? Are we the frog in the, you know, boiling water slowly, you know? And will we look back on it as you point out just now, like, are we going to look back on it and be like, oh, well, that was ridiculous. Or 50 years from now, I'm going to look back and say, you know, this was the moment that America took this turn. And then we had this long, you know, struggle to pull ourselves out of it.
Yeah, no, that's the crucial thing about pivotal moments, points of divergence in history. We are at one of those inflection points where things could easily go in a certain direction. And if we, you know, again, I'll put my political biases very upfront, you know, if, as I hope, Joe Biden is reelected and the Democrats retain control over at least the presidency, and we avert this, you know, clear threat, whatever one wants to call it, you know, people may end up finding this outcome as confirmation of American exceptionalism, that at a time of, you know, global right-wing resurgence, we resisted this effort, and it was clear testament to our democratic bona fides that trace all the way back to 1776, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, you know, we could easily point out, as I think you and I would probably agree, that, you know, this idea that America has always embraced democracy with its mother's milk, we've never had any fascist tendencies, is totally bunk, which is why, you know, Rachel Maddow's new book, Prequel, and her podcast, Ultra, are so popular, because everyone wants to see, well, what are the origins of our present day right wing, you know, movements. And so we can always find sources in the past for things going on in the present. But from my perspective, I wrote this book partly to not have that hindsight bias being decisive, but to see what people were saying in the moment when the future was still unknown. Because that's sort of the exact moment we're in now, where we don't know what the future holds. And so if we can learn from the best practices of the past, and how people in a period of uncertainty and instability acted, maybe we can see the justifiability of being safe rather than sorry. And if we end up using more inflammatory rhetoric, maybe there is a price to be paid for some of that. I think we both know that, you know, endless calls about fascism that never arrive can lead people to become desensitized. On the other hand, if there really are fascists out there who are intending ill will to our political system, then maybe we ought to know what the Germans did to protect their political system in the 40s and 50s.
And this is one of the points that you make in the book, which is that in some ways, I'm using hysteria in air quotes here, but, and that, because I'm talking about with the hindsight bias, but you make the argument that essentially what we now look upon as sort of hysteria about calling out the Fourth Reich, And the fact that the Fourth Reich then becomes kind of a caricatured, cartoonish idea, paradoxically, may have been exactly what you're talking about. That because people were hypersensitive to it, that's why it was never able to sort of get a foothold, right?
Yeah.
But to bring it back to the history a little bit, one of the, and I'm not sure if you mentioned, I think this is the quote. I think Adenauer said something like, we could have had, in the post-war period, we could have had justice or democracy, but not both.
Right.
When it comes to confronting Nazi war criminals, and you talk about that in the book as well, and the effect that that has on essentially the Germany's what we'll call unsatisfying approach to prosecuting Nazis. You know, what is the role that has in either sort of allowing or preventing an actual resurgence of the Fourth Reich, and or rather, how does the fact that there were Nazis left around perhaps perpetuate the fear of the Fourth Reich?
Sure, I mean, it's a huge question. It's again one of the master narratives of post-war German memory studies. This idea associated with Hermann Lubbe that the only way Germany could have democratized after World War II is by repressing the reality of Nazism, integrating all the former perpetrators into the post-war system, and basically forgetting. In other words, amnesia was the price paid for democracy. The premise being, and again, it's a counterfactual, if the German Democrats who wanted to rebuild Germany as a democracy had decided to take all 8 million Nazi party members from 1933 or 39 and hold them accountable for their crimes and prevent them from getting jobs as school teachers and judges and milkmen or whatever, those people would have so much resentment towards the post-war democratic order, they would have, you know, worked to undermine it. And so, you know, forgetting their past, giving them a slap on the wrist, making sure they had a job. And so by 1957, 58, 59, Germany has 0% unemployment, and all the ex-Nazis are doing well. Well, you know, that's morally problematic, but it's good for the sake of the Western alliance and democracy in Europe. Now, in the short term, I don't think there's much argument that that, you know, was the right decision. People like Jeffrey Herf, you know, have long argued that there were alternatives to that policy of amnesia and democratization. You could have maybe had your cake and eaten it too. You could have had democratization with a better carrying out of justice. And I argue in the book that there is a case to be made that a lot of the people who were integrated into the post-war political system, whether in, you know, the German equivalent of the FBI or in the police forces or whatever, like, they could have been a liability had Germany not had the economic success and stability that it did in the 1950s. Because one's political loyalty to any system is usually dependent on your social and economic well-being. And had there been, for example, no economic boom in Germany because of the Korean War, or if Germany's reparations payments to the Western Allies from World War I hadn't been forgiven to a certain degree, in other words, if Germany had had much more of a tenuous economic situation, and remember, in the early 50s, the unemployment rate was still 14%, having tons and tons of ex-Nazis in the judiciary, in the civil service, that could have become toxic. Fortunately, it never came to anything because the overall structure of Adenauer's administration was stable enough. But, you know, it's, you take it again to the present. If you think about the people who, you know, could be in a future Trump administration, you know, you could have a lot of tremendous instability if you have, you know, a recession in the U.S. And that, by the way, would have easily been the case, you know, in the 4 years from 2016 to 2020. I mean, some of the
there's also a macro micro element here too, I think, certainly in the German context, right? Where, you know, the fact that Adenauer doesn't, I think, as some people would say, essentially tear the country apart in coming to terms with the past, right? By some kind of massively punitive and invasive attempt at, essentially, at this point, we're talking about a judicial reckoning. You know, because he doesn't do that, he buys this macro arc toward democracy, but at the expense of the actual literal justice for Holocaust victims, you know, of exactly having the fact that, I mean, I remember reading, I think it was in Rebecca Wittmann's book about the Auschwitz trial, where, you know, they busted in on a guy's house they were investigating. And he was in the police, and on his desk, on his kitchen table, he had all the case files from the case against him, along with the, you know, the witnesses and their addresses. I mean, like, so, you know, this compromise is very much a compromise that was not without its own victims, because the victim of the Adenauer compromise in this sense is all of the Nazis who lived long and fruitful lives, who were legitimate, you know, actual criminals that had actually done, you know, horrible things, which
is, no, for sure.
You know,
and it highlights the fact, moreover, that Germany's democracy in terms of its international reputation took a hit because of the constant press coverage of ex-Nazis in Adenauer's cabinet, like Hans Globke, endless talk in the Western, especially British and American press about re-Nazification, endless opportunities for the East German government to expose West Germany as non-reliable. So until the, you know, transition of power from, I guess it was Ludwig Erhard to Willy Brandt, or from Kiesinger to Brandt in 69, only with the first peaceful handover of power from the CDU to the SPD only then did Western observers start to warm up to the idea that Germany's democracy was actually mature. And even until reunification, as we both know, in 1990, there were still plenty of people who viewed Germany as on probation because of the closet Nazis or the
Nazi
legacy. Well,
and still do in a lot of ways. I mean, I remember in the 2000s when I think Germany sent Bundeswehr soldiers to Afghanistan or Iraq, one of the two. But it was like the first time that Germany had sent military forces overseas since World War II. And there, even then, there were people that were like, you know, I'm not. And then, of course, the Bundeswehr didn't help itself by, you know, using the Afrika Korps symbol on some of its vehicles. But, you know, there is this. It's one of those things that on the one hand is sort of unfair because I think we're now at the point where it's fairly certain that we're not going to have a Nazi Germany anymore. But, you know, it's one of those things that is a testament to kind of the phenomenon that you have identified of, you know, this is something that is a fear, right?
Right.
And one of the things. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and it raises the interesting question of whether these fears and these accusations about a looming Fourth Reich, whether they're being made in good faith or bad faith. Because
yeah.
I think, you know, people who don't like Germany's being potentially involved in, you know, foreign military zones probably don't, I'm guessing, think that circa 2024 or 1997 or 2006, that it's really likely there's going to be a Nazi regime emerging in Germany, but they can still use it as a cudgel. You know, the
right.
accusation of a Fourth Reich or a new fascist movement to beat Germany over the head with. And that's what I would call a more instrumentalized, tendentious, maybe bad faith use of
yeah.
a Nazi comparison. Whereas in the early 50s, people were very much sincere about it. And
well,
I think
you had,
a lot more...
you had Wehrmacht generals in the Bundeswehr. I mean, you know, it wasn't, and you had even, you know, even before that, you had Patton before he died saying we really should. What we should really do is turn the Wehrmacht around and point them at the Soviet Union and
yeah.
fight alongside them, you know, which is a its own sort of imagined kind of Fourth Reich in a way. You know, it's kind
yeah.
of like handing over the keys to the guys that were driving the car before, just this time we're, you know, in the passenger seat.
Yeah, and at a certain discursive level, the Fourth Reich is literally no different from the phrase fascism or fascist, because it's an easy way to get attention for your cause, whatever that cause is, and sound the alarm bells for your constituency. So when James Baldwin or, you know, the Black Panthers in the late 60s accused Richard Nixon of bringing about a Fourth Reich in America and that there are going to be concentration camps in Philadelphia and New York City for Black radicals, you know, obviously there's a rhetorical element to that, but I can't say that I don't know whether James Baldwin really thought that fascism was on the horizon in the United States. Again, looking back on it, it seems very overblown. But to try and get into the thinking of people in the moment who are using these phrases, and then to trace how they, you know, end up confirming the same pattern of usage over and over and over and over again. I'd start at the beginning of the book by saying there never was a Fourth Reich, and to this date, there hasn't ever been one. But you still see, you know, over the course of 80, 90 years, people talking about it incessantly. So what does that mean about the concept as such? Is it useful? Is it useless? You know, I think there's some arguments to be made for both.
Well, one of the things that one of the things that I found really, really interesting, and I mentioned this before we started recording, you know, like all the films and books and things that I kind of interested in now checking out that you mentioned, the way that the Fourth Reich, the idea of a Fourth Reich is reflected in popular culture. And in my mind, it kind of connects with zombie films in the sense that, you know, zombie films are often about public anxieties about unrelated things, but they provide mm-hmm. sort of a vehicle for that. Can we just talk about some of these amazing examples from popular culture about the way in which this imaginary Fourth Reich, which in this case is almost always sort of a Nazi resurgent version, is
sure.
used?
I mean, the 70s are, I mean, they start in the 60s and 70s. They reach their apex in films like The Boys from Brazil, which was also a novel by Ira Levin, starring Gregory Peck, I think, as Dr. Mengele. You've got Frederick Forsyth's The Odessa File. You've got Robert Ludlum's The Holcroft Covenant. They're all kinds of dastardly, you know, cookie-cutter Nazi villains, not just, you know, trying to enrich themselves after the war or committing, you know, crimes of passion against individuals. They're literally politically plotting to take over the world. And what I argue in this particular chapter, and there are Mission Impossible episodes, there's comic books, there's all kinds of stuff where you see these tropes just recycled over and over. They did begin seriously, in earnest, in the early 1960s, in response to, not surprisingly, the Eichmann trial, to the subsequent war crimes trials, the Auschwitz trial, the exposing to the larger audience of people in the West that there were still Nazis in Germany. And, you know, the furor over the flight of Mengele, of Bormann, a lot of the Hitler wave of the early 1970s fed into this as well. All the myths of him taking a submarine to Argentina and so forth. People were making bank with this kind of stuff, no question. Hollywood studios, you know, publishing houses and so forth. But what it really did was popularize the phrase, the Fourth Reich, to become just like an iconic phrase among Western audiences. And here we're talking especially about the people that grew up as kids in the 60s and 70s, people who didn't fight in the war as combat veterans or anything like that. They're taking it one level removed, and they're having all of these images being mediated through, again, Pulp Fiction, Hollywood cinema, and so forth. But it does create a kind of staying power to this idea of the Fourth Reich, so much so that when you think about some of the shows that have been streaming online in recent years in the United States, like The Man in the High Castle.
Right, I was going to mention this one.
Yeah, or, you know, Watchmen, or The Plot Against America, or Hunters, starring Al Pacino, which, by the way, if any of your listeners are interested in streaming, two seasons of a great schlocky series set in the 1970s in New York City, where a bunch of Nazi war criminals who have been brought into the United States through Operation Paperclip, they're plotting a Fourth Reich. I mean, there's literally a whole cottage industry of pop culture artifacts promoting these sort of the belief in these ideas. And partly, I guess, there's a morally upright purpose to it. It's keeping us always vigilant and on guard against the possibility of resurgent Nazism. But of course, in a climate of Trumpism and MAGAism, there's a lot more plausibility to those plot points, which is why I think we've seen so many of those shows, you know, kind of coming about in recent years.
Well,
and with all the predictable political response.
Not to interrupt, but I also, with The Man in High Castle, because I was curious about that. I didn't know, you know, see what your thoughts were on this one. There's also something voyeuristic about it. You know, imagining what a world in which the Nazis won. So it's not really a Fourth Reich. It's sort of like Third Reich extended, right? Or actual Third Reich,
exactly.
You know, but because we're imagining it, it does kind of fall into this Fourth Reich category, right? Because it's a Reich that never took place. But I put it in the context of, you know, I often talk with people that are aficionados of World War II history, you know, and sometimes you get people saying, well, you know, if only Hitler had done this, if only the Wehrmacht had done this, they would have won, you know, World War II. Or, you know, what do you think that if the Nazis had done this, that, or other thing on the Eastern Front, could they have won?
Mm-hmm.
And my question is always, what's behind that question itself, right? Why do we want to imagine how the Nazis could have won? But it seems like Man in the High Castle is exactly that. You know, Man in the High Castle, I think, also plays into this Red Dawn kind of fantasy in America, where, you know, we get to be the resistance in a certain sense.
Right. Well, there's a lot of psychological forces underpinning all counterfactuals. I mean, one of the most basic ones is that when you imagine a nightmare of something that never happened, it's usually to express relief for the way things actually turned out.
Mm.
So, you know, British and American viewers love the premise of the Nazis winning World War II, because it allows us to feel gratitude for us having won World War II and reliving the finest hour, or, you know, the greatest generation, or the good war, or all these sort of famous ideas. But you pointed out something important just a second ago when you said that, you know, it allows us to, you know, sort of vicariously imagine being part of the resistance. What you actually notice, and I talked a lot about this in my book, The World Hitler Never Made, is that when you look at how British and American novelists, filmmakers, and so forth have imagined the scenario of a Nazi victory in World War II, it's usually to express feelings one way or the other about how the American or how the British population would have behaved under occupation.
Right.
And in the patriotic moments of American and British memory after World War II, of course, every last man and woman was part of the resistance. But in moments of time, say, especially in the 60s, when in Britain there was a lot of, you know, malaise about the loss of empire, and in America during the Vietnam War, you see a lot of people scratching their heads and saying, well, you know what, maybe we would have actually collaborated. Maybe we would have been able, wouldn't have been able to, you know, do the right patriotic thing. We would have jumped into bed with the Nazis. We would have killed our own neighbors. And that's a way of offering a more self-critical take on one's own country, one's own history. And you tend to see those self-critical alternate histories emerging in times of national, you know, malaise. And I think in the same time, when you see Trumpism emerging in 2015-16, and then you see the Man in the High Castle routinely showing countless Americans behaving immorally and jumping into bed with the Nazis, that's a way of saying, hey, we have fascism within us ourselves. We shouldn't be complacent and think we're always going to be on the right side of things.
Yeah, I mean, and this is something that you touch on a little bit, is the Fourth Reich and its universalization, right? So when it ceases to become a specific fear that Germany is going to do it, and becomes sort of, well, again, it's this tension, right, between the rhetorical and the sort of instrumental plan with regards to American neo-Nazism. And
sure,
on the one hand, actual neo-Nazis who are like, let's try to make or return, however you want to think about it, United States to a white supremacist state. And then the rhetoric of, that you mentioned, for example, the Black Power people and some civil rights people who are comparing, you know, and I think that there's an important conversation here that we had about, which is also relevant to the modern context of, we didn't need the Nazis to imagine and invent white supremacy and invent, you know, sort of fascism in the United States. You know, it can be a foil, it can be a goal or a language, but it's not an import.
Yeah, no, I think the thing is that what you referred to correctly as the universalization of the Fourth Reich basically takes place in the 60s, when for the first time, many people in the West, it's Britain and America, Canada, North America, wherever, who had been afraid of a Fourth Reich emerging in Germany, 25 years after World War II was over, they had kind of gotten over their immediate fears. And what they instead begin to realize is that because of domestic instability in the United States, keep in mind, you know, 68, Martin Luther King and RFK are assassinated, the Vietnam War is going haywire, you've got violence at the Chicago Convention, and you've got people like George Lincoln Rockwell and the American Nazi Party emerging. You know, there's serious fears that America is now the place we have to worry about more about surging Nazism or far-right extremism than anywhere else. And really, from that point on, you see the Fourth Reich appearing in other contexts. So people who are opposed to apartheid in South Africa were referring to South Africa as the Fourth Reich. When the Greek military junta came into power in the 70s, people used the same thing to, you know, the same phrase to refer to the Greek far right. So what you basically see over time is a term that was originally meant to be a symbol of a progressive Germany that would emerge after the Third Reich becomes, you know, fixated and associated with the German far right for a whole generation until it becomes so broadly universalized that it can become an all-purpose signifier for anything on the far right that anyone doesn't like fascism, like Nazism, like calling someone Hitler. I think the unique thing about the phrase Fourth Reich is that it doesn't just call someone fascist or talk about fascism in the moment. It actually says, here's the end result, the worst case scenario of what might take place if we don't act now. A Fourth Reich, an institutionalized fascist state led by a neo-Hitler of some kind. And so in a way, the Fourth Reich is the rhetorical, you know, it's rhetorically one-upping everybody else because it positions that end result as the final threat that we have to be on guard against.
Right. And it's also in some ways a conversation ender. You see this sometimes, I mean, sometimes it's used disingenuously by people who are fascist to sort of say, you know, oh, well, your ultimate response is just call me a Nazi and that's to end the conversation. But on the other hand, you know, sometimes if you call someone a Nazi, then there's no, what are you going to do? Right, and it's, you can't get better from that. There's nowhere to sort of go from there.
Sure, and unfortunately, the right has begun. I mean, it's typically been a left-wing talking point or slogan that's been used to condemn Nixon or to condemn Vietnam War, or LBJ, or Donald Trump. But you do now see in an era of right-wing Holocaust inversion where they're attacking COVID vaccine requirements, so they're attacking Obamacare as a sign of a looming Nazi state. You see it all the time now. Right wingers saying under Biden we've got a Fourth Reich in the making, and I would totally accuse those charges of being done in bad faith. Whereas the people who are afraid of Trumpism paving the way to fascism, again, I know I probably sound biased here, but I think there's a lot more plausibility to those claims than from the other end of the spectrum.
No, of course. I mean, and one of the things that I've noticed as well, and I'm sure you have too, is there's a very bizarre inversion, and the COVID is a good example of this, though. I think COVID is interesting because you had people on both extreme ends of the political spectrum using the Nazi term for the same purposes, right? Of the government basically making me do something that I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting. But you also have, the use of the Jewish star, for example. And,
right.
My vaccine badge is the same thing as the Jewish star. The government making me register my guns is what the Nazis did to take away, the Jews' right to resist. These kinds of rhetorical things, where oftentimes it's the people who are essentially the victimizers that are imagining themselves to be the victims, which of course has a longer history going all the way back to the actual Nazis themselves doing this kind of thing. But it's a really interesting sort of mental gymnastics that takes place of the far. I mean, it's very weird to hear the far right essentially proposing policies that are in some ways analogous to policies that the Nazis would have agreed with, and then call other people Nazis as an insult. It's kind of a weird paradox there.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, I highly recommend everyone really take a look at this book. There's a lot more to it than we covered today, but it also makes us think about a lot of really important things about how these fears, both justified and perhaps not justified as it turns out in some instances, lead us to thinking about how people at the time were experiencing these things. Because I think one of the things that certainly our conversation today has highlighted, and the book too, is this idea of, we don't know whether or not we're at a pivotal moment in history, right? I mean, because it's almost always hindsight in the sense of looking back, oh, that was a pivotal moment in history. But, very rarely are we at least certain that we're living in one. And we can only act mm-hmm. with our best judgment at the time, which I think actually going all the way back to Adenauer, that's a really great example of this. You have a guy who had to make a decision because he didn't live in an ideal theoretical world. He lived in a world where he had to make a decision, a political decision about how do we approach this.
Yep.
And he made one because he made one in the time that he was in based on the knowledge that he had. Doesn't mean that we can't look back on it and say that was a good, bad, or middling decision, but we have to make decisions at the time that we're in.
Yeah, and we can only judge those decisions once we know the end of the story. And
yeah.
The problem is we're living at a time right now where we don't know what the end of our story is going to be on any number of fronts. The Middle East war, climate change, whether there'll be another January 6th, you name it. I mean, we're really, and that it's, some people refer to our poly crisis and so forth, but on just so many narrative fronts, we're uncertain. So I feel like it's all hands on deck politically to be sure that we're, aware of the stakes of all these different issues, and we can, do what we can in, a liberal democratic setting to have our concerns be registered.
And of course, in the background of all of this, which is a conversation for a whole nother podcast, you know, is the value of a comparative historical approach, you know, and the value of what I would call reasonable and rational comparisons between fascism and Nazism and conservatism. And, you know, there, you know, history is not always predictive, but, you know, there are things that are, that can be similar. And as long as one is approaching this in sort of a rational, reasonable perspective, you know, the comparative is something that helps us judge this moment, you know, and we can say, you know, there have been moments like this in the past that are very similar in these series of factors. And, you know, that can hopefully help us to make the right decisions, right? Without getting too much into it.
Yeah, we can draw our own comparisons. We can make them as educated historians, and hopefully the general public will find them plausible. And we can also call out the irresponsible comparisons made by partisans on whatever wing of the spectrum. Because, you know, one of the byproducts of Holocaust education literacy is everyone thinks they know what happened in that era and feel entitled to make comparisons no matter how far-fetched they are. So that's, you know, whatever. The opposite of the silver lining, I guess.
Exactly.
Greater historical literacy.
That's the burden, right, that comes with the greater historical literacy. So before I let you go, I always like to put our guests who are, you know, always knowledgeable on the Holocaust on the spot by asking them, you know, what is one book that you would recommend about the Holocaust as useful, or one that has been particularly impactful for you, with the understandable caveat that there is no one book. And, you know, this, your answer may change on any given day of the week. But on this day of the week today, Gav, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, I guess one book that I would throw out, which is unconventional, because I was going to say, you know, Saul Friedlander's two-volume magnum opus on the Holocaust was a book that I worked on as a research assistant for him, like sentimental, you know, feelings about helping him in the early 90s gather sources for that. I mean, it would be easy for me to say that, but maybe a bit more of an outside-the-box book is Jeffrey Gurok, who's a professor at history professor at Yeshiva University. He wrote a book called The Holocaust Averted, and it's a counterfactual reflection on, if the Holocaust hadn't happened, how would American Jewish and European Jewish history have been different?
Wow.
So it is an exercise in counterfactual history. I think it came out in 2015 or so. It's super interesting. And it's a way of approaching the topic from a sort of reverse perspective of what might have happened but didn't. And usually, as I quoted Hugh Trevor Roper earlier, by seeing what could have happened, it will help you get a clear understanding of what actually did. So The Holocaust Averted.
Great. It was The Holocaust Averted. Gav, thanks so much for coming. On the show notes, we'll have a link to The Fourth Reich, The Specter of Nazism from World War II to the Present. Gav, where can people find you on Twitter, social media?
Yep. I'm on Twitter. I'm on, do I have to look up my handle?
No, I'll put it in there as well. Yeah, if you don't know it, that's totally fine. Again,
yeah, I mean, you can just go on GavrielRosenfeld.com. That's my homepage with all the journalistic stuff and the news, whatever. But yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Wayman.
Okay, bye-bye.